draft before. Okay, Kristen. So I'm going to call the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Public Safety to order. Today we are here to have a public hearing on Senate Bill 5523, which is the Judicial Department. So I'm going to open the public hearing on Senate Bill 5523. This whole week we will be hearing from the courts. We're glad to see you here today. And Robin, do you want to lead off? And
I do. Okay. You should have in front of you a memo that I also distributed last week, so if you had a chance to look at it, great. What you have in front of you is a graphic display of the agency budget and the Legislative Fiscal Office analysis of the governor's budget. The agency had a number of budget notes, and I'm not going to read them, or we'll be here all week. But the agency will talk to you about the actions that they have taken in response to these budget notes. There were no Secretary of State audit reports. There were emergency board reports, and the agency will talk about those as well. There are no state-to-state comparisons. At least I didn't get any. And the vacancy report, prioritized list of services and management staff ratios will be presented. Well, not the vacancy report. I will deal with that in work session. The others will be provided by the department during its presentation.
Okay.
Moving.
Go ahead.
Did you have a question?
No, no.
Moving on to the PowerPoint presentation. The first couple of slides are just placeholders, headers. So moving to the slide having to do with, I'm trying to work off from my notes and from this at the same time. Let me see what page number that is.
Six.
Page six. All right.
We'll follow on.
Mm-hmm. All right.
We got the bouncing
actually,
ball.
Actually, page seven. The first graphic shows the breakdown of the department's divisions. And as it illustrates, the trial courts are the largest division within the department, followed by administration, and then the appellate and tax courts and mandated payments. Within the administration and appellate division, the state assessment and central support costs are almost half of the division's expenditures. Information technology is 24%. Appellate and tax courts are 25%. And then law library is a small portion of the budget. The next slide just gives you an overview of the breakdown of the department's budget over a period of time going back to 1995. This slide illustrates that the governor funds the department at $10 million above the legislatively approved budget through the fifth special legislative session. There were no additional reductions in the sixth special legislative session. However, the governor's budget is a reduction of $3.1 million below the legislatively adopted budget at the close of the 2001-2003 legislative session. By constitution, judicial salaries cannot be reduced during the term of a sitting judge. Since judicial salaries represent 24% of all salary expense, and since staffing is the major judicial department expense, the department must make disproportionate cuts to staff in order to manage budget reductions. What this slide illustrates is that the department has some limits on its flexibility to deal with the budget reductions. The Chief Justice operating level budget issues include the governor's budget does not fund the Chief Justice's operating level budget, which includes inflation and merit pay increases. and the governor's budget does not fund any of the Chief Justice's policy packages, including $6 million and 61.19 FTE to restore special session cuts, and $6 million and 61.73 FTE for workload growth. Moving on to workload issues. What I have done with this is to take first of all, to give you an overview of all of the filings, and then to take cuts of the various pieces and talk about them. Violations are the largest category of all case filings, but they do involve the least amount of judicial and staff time per resolution. All other cases include civil matters, probate, and domestic relations, and small claims. Violations show the most volatility of all case types. They have fluctuated significantly, and some of this is tied to local law enforcement resources. Felony filings are down from a peak in 1998, and misdemeanors are down from a peak in 1990. There were 39,589 felony case filings in 1998. In 2002, there were 37,905. There were 76,754 misdemeanor filings in 1990 and 65,549 misdemeanors in 2002. I would point out that the raw filing data does not reflect any changes in case complexity, and we have periodically tried to figure out how to analyze the changes in case complexity, but I have to admit we have not yet been able to come up with a satisfactory methodology for doing that.
Mr. Chair?
President Butler?
As I look through those four graphs dealing with the violations and violation filings, major categories, felony filings, juvenile case filings, it appears that there's a dip there starting at about 1991 through 94-95, right in that, and then swing back up. What's the phenomenon that occurs there? Is that Measure 11?
Mr. Chair, Representative Butler, we were trying to figure that out, and I don't think that that's, I don't believe that that has anything to do with Measure 11. What I theorize is government is always a lagging indicator, and we were having a bit of an economic recession
in
91. It takes a while for reductions to trickle through to government, and that there were reductions in local law enforcement and other things at that time.
So based upon that, we've got a current downward trend.
Right.
Row 203.
I think.
Representative Hanson.
The other one that was occurring at that same time that might be more important than the economic condition was implementation Measure 5, which took property taxes,
right,
property tax resources away from local government.
Started phasing in 92.
Yeah, I will admit, Mr. Chair, members, I really don't know for sure, but my theory is that there are factors at work that,
Representative Hanson, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the things that was kind of interesting this morning in transportation, we were looking at the transportation safety department numbers, and I'm trying to figure out where there's a correlation between accident and fatalities and either police presence or in this case the number of tickets and violations that were wrote. That seems like we've had kind of a general falling of the fatality rates that seems to be almost irrelevant to the amount of law enforcement dollars we're spending.
I think if at least in my talking to the safety division at ODOT, I think that that's more related to airbags, seatbelt laws, and improvements in vehicle construction and federal requirements, as opposed to at least on the fatality piece. Speeding, I don't know.
Clearly on the fatalities, whether what the relationship on the overall accident rate is, I don't know.
I'm looking at it.
All right.
And again, a graphic for which I have no particular explanation, but juvenile case filings are also down from a peak in 1996. And why it peaked in 1996, I don't know. The overall filing trend for all other case types is generally slow growth over time. There aren't the big peaks and valleys with the civil side as there are with some of the violation and misdemeanor type cases. The filings per judicial position were increasing, but should drop with the six new judicial positions that we that were approved in the 2001-03 biennium. Three positions came online on January 1st, and three will come online on June 30th of this year.
And just so the committee knows, too, you know, those I believe those positions have been elected, but we have asked that those be priced to see if we were to eliminate those positions before they went into effect, what the consequence would be. We've been asked to price those. So.
Active pending cases per judge were increasing faster than filings per judge. And again, this should drop with the six new judgeships that come online. This was a major factor behind the concern over needing the new judgeships, because as your pending caseload goes up, the backlog in the courts increase. However, what we don't know is whether or not the pending caseload, even with the new judgeships, will be adversely affected by the reduced court hours and staff availability to timely process cases. The next couple of graphics I actually borrowed from the Judicial Department, and they will talk to you in some detail later on, but what they show is court-generated revenue and the effect of the reductions in the governor's balanced budget as correlated to the projected revenue. And then the second slide just shows how the revenue is distributed, so that you've got a feel for who benefits from the revenue that's collected by the department. And then finally, the issues that the committee probably needs to be looking at as we were thinking about as we move through the Judicial Department presentation are issues involving statutory and constitutional case priorities, reductions to court hours and effect on pending caseload, revenue impacts including the effect on CFAA, future filing trends and impact on workload, and need for long-term strategies to deal with the budget crisis, including potential alternatives to court hour reductions. And with that, Mr. Chair, I will conclude my presentation.
Thanks, Riley. This is a unique budget compared to what we've normally looked at, because the Chief Justice is here with the Chief Justice's budget, and then the governor has made a budget recommendation as well. So just want to put that on. I think Nancy Miller's been to each of your offices in regard to this graphic, I think, which all of you have received, to explain kind of some differences that occur. And just so people know at the beginning of the hearing, I've asked the court to look at least to some degree, as to what would some court consolidation look like in terms of judicial districts. And Representative Butler, that should be of high interest to you, since I think that most of those would occur probably in Eastern Oregon, though I haven't been told that. But so that issue has been laid out on the table as possible issues. We talked about the judgeship issue, and we're just trying to look at trying to put up all the options on the wall on this particular issue. I think this budget and the budget for corrections, I think, are the ones that we've been able to identify that at least we believe probably have some holes in it compared to what the governor funded these at. We'll continue to look at that. We're going to continue to look at if there's other places or other jurisdictional issues to deal with in regards to the court. And I know that, well, I think that Justice Carson's aware of those too, and has overseen the formation of the court system, and hopefully not the dismantling, but at least looking at all the efficiencies that we can in terms of shifting jurisdictions and other items. Anything else that the committee would like to say before the chief starts? Representative Butler.
Mr. Chair, just one item that I had relative to the questions that were handed out to the public safety. I think I did have some questions relative to where there might be some efficiencies by working with the justice courts in rural and smaller counties of Oregon. So I'm hopeful that at least that discussion may be held, whether or not there's any legislation that addresses any of that. May yet be decided within separate committees.
And Mr. Chair, I did ask Kelly Friels from the Department of Administrative Services to briefly describe how the governor's budget was derived, if you would like to have him
we'll so do that before that. The chief. Is that all right? Kelly? You can't hold in contempt in here, Kelly.
I'm going to change my presentation. Actually, Mr. Chair, I was hoping you were going to say no, because I really don't have a whole lot to say. For the record, I'm Kelly Friels with the Department of Administrative Services.
Well, it's interesting how a former justice could fund the budget at this level. I'm just interested to know what's inside the governor's mind.
No money, Mr. Chair. Same thing's in your mind. I guess a couple points. One, as you obviously are aware, this is a separate branch of government, so the governor has no authority over it. So in crafting the budget, it was necessary in order to balance within existing resources to put a placeholder budget together for this agency as well as for the legislative branch, Secretary of State, and the Treasurer. So that balancing or that placeholder point was the general fund available as of the fifth special session for 2001-03. I think Robin just wanted me to reinforce the fact that this is a placeholder budget. The governor had no specific policies that drove him toward this specific level of funding of roughly $238 million. And be happy to answer any questions, but that's about the extent of my presentation.
Okay. Any questions? Mr. Chair, I assume we will be going through from the legislative approved budget of 371 versus the adopted budget of 406 to get to this $238 million budget. I'm anxious to see how that sorts out.
I think the Chief and Kingsley will walk you through what changes they've had to make in the court as we go through that. I don't think the ASS has been involved in that to any extent whatsoever.
Sure, I'll let you. Thank you.
You're not going to give us a walk on this budget or anything.
It would be a short walk, Mr. Chair.
All right.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kelly.
Thanks.
I won't hold Kelly's feet to the fire on no current service level budgeting and some of those things we heard in the inaugural address. We can proceed. Mr. Chief Justice, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity of being here. It used to be our biennial dance, but as a result of five special sessions, it seems like it's a fairly frequent opportunity for me. I want to thank the chair and the members of the committee for sharing their time with us. I know you have a lot of burdens and a lot of commitments to your time. I particularly want to thank our legislative fiscal analyst, Robin Lamont, for her steadfast work with us. We don't always agree. You'd probably worry if we did agree, always, but I cannot emphasize too much the fact that she has really put herself into understanding who we are, what we do during the interim, during the session, and speaking, I think, for the judicial branch, I commend you, Ms. Lamont, for your efforts on this behalf. State the obvious, this is the only time that the third branch of government has an opportunity to make its case before Ways and Means. And right now, that's the most important part of whatever we do, are the dollars to do it. I'm going to resist historical context. I've been advised, but there are others on our court and elsewhere that can give you a better historical perspective, going back to Runnymede and Magna Carta and a variety of other things. Your eyes are already glazing. I can see that. So I'm not really the person, the expert, to do that. It is important that I think that we understand, and I know you do, you're all veterans, the three branches, the separation of powers, checks and balances, and how important, what a core value that is to both the federal constitution and the state constitution. It's not just a convenience that the legislature or the executive has come up with and said, okay, we got three general areas. It is constitutionally footed both at the federal level and at the state level. I'm going to resist the comparison to other countries who have not seen fit to have a strong judiciary but have allowed the executive to control whatever it is they have as a form of government. I'm not sure I could get through that and hold on to my sanity, so I was going to work on that, but I will spare you and myself that opportunity. And I will try to resist excessive wringing of hands and whining over the spilled blood that has taken place, particularly since July 7 of 2001, when you folks, we were all here, left at the end of the session, which was a good session for us, I think, on balance, in terms of things we measure by, but it has gone steadily downhill, as you know. Oregon has gone steadily downhill since then. The decisions made by this subcommittee will greatly affect us for the forthcoming 2 years. But I want to also suggest that it will affect us for at least a decade, depending how the decisions come here. Economics 101 from Carson, and I caution you, Oregon is usually the first to tank on the economy and usually the last to make it out. My experience in Marion County, when I was a trial court judge in Marion County, indicated, according to Paul Lipscomb, that after we had, and we went through this before, I have experience, no person should have to go through this twice in a lifetime of firing employees because of income. But we did it in Marion County. Our treasurer invested in Ginnie Mae's in the late 70s, and President Carter thought that 21% interest would be good for the country. And Ginnie Mae's became worthless, or nearly so, and the county tanked. I didn't think counties could go bankrupt until Orange County proved us wrong, but nonetheless, Marion County really went under. We did not lay anybody off, and they were all county employees in those days, this poor state takeover, but they worked 4 days and took a 20% pay cut. We tried to keep the court open for 5 days a week, and that in part informs it, and I'll come back if there's interest why we close on Friday, because spreading four-fifths employment or employee base over 5 days in one court, in my view, doesn't work. But it took, my point is, that according to Paul Lipscomb, who came about the time I left the trial courts, went on the appellate level, it took about 6 years to get all the old judgments into the system and a variety of other things. So it's got a long tail. But you know that. And it's not just the courts. It's others as well. Without the rule of law, I will assert, and others have, without the rule of law, as espoused both in the federal and the state constitution, we are lost as a democracy as we know it. Now, having said that, I've been asked to move to the current status for perspective and tell you about our current experience. And it's been an interesting experience that I'll share with you that continues to unfold. As a result of the fifth special session, we were down a total of $50.1 million in three components. Let me stop there and say I look at our budget as three silos or three stovepipes, is the military phrase for it. We have court operations, we have mandated payments, and we have injured defense. We will not be spending much time on injured defense. You will hear that on Monday and Tuesday when the Public Defense Services Commission appears before you, and I will be back. Sorry about that, but I am a non-voting ex-official member of the commission. So we'll be back Monday and Tuesday to talk to you about injured defense. But that, for now, and at least until 30 June, and perhaps if it's not changed until 1 October, injured defense is a part of our judicial budget. The $50.1 million was lost, and then the Emergency Board, as most of you know, because some of you had a hand in it, restored the last meeting of the emergency board for the regular session came in on the 13th of January. This is, I think, 9 and 10 or so January, another $5 million. So we were down $46.1 million, give or take a few dollars, from the end of July, or July 7 of 2001. As I think probably all of you have been aware, and were aware at the time, the reduction of the last, in our case, $13.6 million occurred with only 4 months to clean up the deficit, and so that exacerbated any kind of problem. We originally, had we gone on with Indian Defense and spent it right up to the contract level we were anticipating, we would have been out of money on April 1. We talked about that and decided we would not do that, but we would try to put it on save the most serious crimes, and that's what we started originally earlier, but on 1 March. I first appointed a group. I was going to call it the Doomsday Committee, but Kingsley, who is more professional than I, called it the Budget Reduction Advisory Committee. In my military experience, I go with the acronym. It's called BRAC, and that seems to sum it all up, which is, well, I won't go there.
Great name.
Yeah, it is. Okay. According to my military experience, the military is about the only, everybody has acronyms, but the military is pretty good at turning acronyms into verb forms. And you're bracked if you get hit on this. And
lucky you're not in front of Representative Butler's committee, because he makes everyone pay for acronym, every acronym they use there.
Whoa.
He makes them pay.
When I come there, I will get rid of it, yeah. But the members of the committee, senior presiding judges, the Chief Justice, the Chief Justice Court of Appeals, and senior trial court administrators, some of whom are here today, then the work staff, and we set about dismantling the court system in order to meet the budget deficit. We considered a number of opportunities, and I'm fairly cheerful about this, more cheerful than I really ought to be, and that is I was told one time that the Chinese characters that identify the word crisis or danger and opportunity. Most of the time I've been working on the danger side of the equation, but I think there are some opportunities which we can talk about later in this crisis that we're into. Basically what we wound up doing is cutting, we called it euphemistically, one thing politics has taught me, we furloughed every staff member in the state judicial branch 10%. Cut their salary 10% and said they didn't have to go to work for 10% or 4 hours. Because we were going to shift the time, we made 4 9-hour days the norm and then closed on Friday, but I'll come to that. I remember Dan Kennedy when I asked after special session 2 how many layoffs there were, and I don't know what the state base now is, 42,000 employees. He said he was aware of 2. In that round off, we, our little agency, if you will, department, laid off 38. It gives you a perspective of what our 12.9% cut with the state government generally at 8.9% over the 5 special sessions came to us. And as Ms. Lamont said, because we're heavy into personnel, if you cut our budget, you cut people, pretty much, because that's where most of our money goes. So we'd laid off some then, and then we had the prospects of laying more off, and we actually, so we furloughed, and then we pink slipped, what was another 60?
Right.
68 people. So if you look at a percentage, we gave it the office. I think probably the Judicial Department laid off more people. Then you go to, we could see this coming, so we kept vacancies open, and I think we're somewhere we're well over 200 layoffs in vacancy non-filled, and I think it's getting closer to 300?
275.
That's close. So that's where we are now, and that's as we present to you. With all of that, with the layoffs, the furloughs, we decided to go, and I'm responsible for this, to go to a 4-day work day. I say in part it was based, if not in large part, on my experience in Marion County when we tried to make do with a 20% workforce reduction, and now we have approximately a 27% workforce reduction. It just doesn't work. So we went to 4 days, and we're operating under that. So those were the critical elements. And if you, there is a handout, Court Operations Budget Reduction Plan fact sheet, shows you the cuts, the short-term plan. The court closures are a result of layoffs and our delay of certain cases. we chose the list of priorities. We just prioritized, started in 91, what it is we do.
This is in the packet.
Yes.
This,
I'm sorry.
This is in the packet of items between the two large yellow sheets, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We started in 91 when we had another shortfall and concern in budget to take a look at what all we do, and we started redoing that a couple of years ago, and it was primarily derived from our presiding judges, which are usually the most experienced members of the trial court, and the TCAs that are the chief administrators at the trial level. And we came up with a list of, it's now 18, of things, and the priority list is stuff at the top is our most important things. We want to hold on to those to the very last, and the pieces at the bottom are the things that we don't want to get rid of, and we can talk about that when we talk about JP courts. We don't want to get rid of, but we can't do our citizen service if we're not funded in order to do those. Now, you will see that what we've done is melded what you've already decided in terms of priorities. You may not look at it this way. I do, having been on the Criminal Revision Commission in 1971, that we take it, the fact that you put something in the category of a felony, it is the most serious felony next to aggravated murder / death penalty. So we're going to try and protect a felonies to the very end, and then B and C and so on. So generally the list is built there. We came up with what the cases that were getting deferred, and I'll speak to that. Getting deferred were basically small claims, and there have been some adjustments with the help of the chair of this committee and others, slight adjustments to that prohibition, and quite important. And non-person misdemeanors, we are deferring appointment of attorneys because we don't have the money to appoint them now. If we appoint them now, we won't have money for the ballot measure 11 and other things toward the end of the biennium. Non-person misdemeanors are significant. I don't mean to demean their nature. There are such things as prostitution. I suppose a lot of the things that went on Representative Henson's town this weekend would be in the non-person misdemeanors, although some of them, I suppose, any interference with a police officer, assault or whatever, would be still there. But the effect of it is it will be postponed until after July 1, when we anticipate. When we started this, we thought the revenue estimates would go up, perhaps mistakenly. That there would be some a rainbow at the end of this, or a pot of gold, or something to come back. So that's why we deferred. I want to caution you that I'm not giving a legal opinion. I can't act without three other people. But I would suggest that when we're being sued for a four-month deferral, it's violating speedy trial and equal protection and a variety of other things. I will await the outcome of that litigation. But if to do it for another 2 years, in other words, continue the short-range plan is not one of the things that are available to us. It ought to expire June 30, because delaying the appointment of counsel on these cases, no matter what we decide, is the best thing to do for Oregonians. The deferral is a limited opportunity that we have. A deferral of 4 months is one thing. Deferral of 28 months is very problematic, to say the least. With that, Chair, I think I've done what has been assigned to me. I'll check. I think so. And if you want to stop, I'll try to respond to questions, or we can roll right into Ms. Clicks.
Any questions for the Chief or how this list was derived, put together? All right. Representative Hanson.
Thank you. Certainly on small claims and on violations. Those, as I understand it, those actually generate dollars for...
Yes.
Okay. So by having those as a very low priority, does that force us to go... Do they generate enough dollars to actually be self-sufficient? Or I guess what I can understand in terms of the relative importance of certain types of activities, those might be lesser priorities. But from a financial sense, does it make our situation worse that we have to cut deeper at going up the list?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hanson, you're absolutely correct. This is not an economic model. We in the BRAC committee took a look at our revenues and said, okay, let's keep the ones that make money. Parking in your county, or in your city, rather, is as Ms. Lamont mentioned, violations come in two areas. One is the cash register justice, where most of them are resolved by mail or at the cash register at the clerk's office. And only a few of them gravitate on up to a judge. It used to be a district court, and now it's a circuit court judge. But there are other violations. In fact, one of the things you can watch, one of the ways the DAs are meeting this very serious problem is reducing misdemeanors, I'm told, I haven't seen it yet, reducing misdemeanors to violations, because violations contain no jail time. Hence, there's no need for appointment of counsel, or at least that's the theory, the result of which is those can be handled. So there are two kinds of violations. The vast majority, I think, well, I'm confident, the vast majority is, as Ms. Lamont depicted, that are traffic violations. Traffic crimes are a different matter and are shown elsewhere, but there are violations that are going to continue to grow that still involve, they're not traffic, they're not cash register, they are reduced misdemeanors that will intend to try to avoid the huge bulge we're going to have. I rejected the economic model, realizing, however, you know, for instance, I was informed, and Doug Bray, the trial court administrator, can confirm this or set the record straight, that Multnomah County makes money, judiciary makes money, if you took out injured and defense. And in part, I think, parking and violations and some of these other things. You add on injured and defense, then they don't. And that's generally true with most. So this is not a revenue model. And as a member, an important member of one of the caucuses shared with me a couple of weeks ago, that there have been those who have suggested that we went through the list of crimes and picked out those that would do the most serious injury to you, the revenue-concerned people. I can assure you, no, we didn't do that. Keep small claims and get rid of aggravated murder. We could save a bundle. But then think about that resolution, and we rejected that out of hand. So these are based primarily on our perception of what is important to the community. But and we do have the figures. We can tell you within reason. If, for instance, one of the plans, and we have given a 59-page document to the chairman of judiciary, because one of the options available is take this off our plate, things that we can't do anymore because you can't fund us, let somebody else do them or no longer provide the service. And so there are a huge number of lists, many of which you will never get to, I hope, but some will incur maybe transfer to JP courts or municipal courts. I think that would be wrong, but be glad to explain why. And it has a very huge revenue impact. So I would ask you, as one of my colleagues used to say, he's no longer at the court, keep your finger on that point, because we'll be back to it, because that becomes very important for you, because you're the ones who are trying to raise the revenue and other to support government, which you're absolutely right.
Question? Senator Devlin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chief Justice, apologize for being late, but I'm supposed to be in three places at the same time, and they're going to come get me again in about 15 minutes. I can understand the rationale for the priorities. Probably I agree with the rationale for the priorities. But let me give you a comparison of something that's before the committee and get your reaction to this, because I think it's similar in nature. One of the things that has been cut in the state police budget is the funds that were being dedicated and the staff that was being dedicated towards the collection of taxes for tobacco, obviously to keep us in compliance with the settlement agreement. Well, that's something I think that we will probably end up believing we have to restore if we're going to keep that flow of funds, which actually is now probably largely going to be going to pay back certain securities. But at the same time, there's this dynamic in doing that. We have to maybe put that back in so that we collect this revenue. And in theory, the revenue is so that it would be available for other purposes. And so we're looking at it and saying, or at least I'm looking at it and saying, that certainly this is not as high a priority as some of the investigators we might have to cut in the Criminal Investigations Division for the state police. But in the same way, we may have to do it so we have that revenue. So, I mean, sometimes there's a sort of a circular I mean, I don't think you could justify doing small claims over manslaughter cases or murder cases, obviously. But if we lose the revenue, we ultimately probably lose some of those capabilities. So,
Mr. Chair, Senator Devlin, you're absolutely right. And it's not that we haven't thought about that. It's that we took our mission in public safety. And one of the interesting things, I was heartened by the fact, 10 days ago I saw an article in the Statesman that suggested that the leadership of your respective bodies was considering visiting priorities. You won't find, I will assert, a list like this in most of state government, where we have told you what we want to hold on to and what you can cut. And we can also tell you how much you save by cutting it, or where we are now, and depending on whose budget you follow, what's going to happen, unless there's some other efforts. It seems to me that you must keep one eye on revenue or the consequences of revenue. But I would encourage you, and that's what I got from the article, I see no sign of it, is to move away from the stovepipes that the perfidy is not the right word, but the fact that we're in public safety, somebody decided who goes in. First, that there'd be a long time ago, before I got on the scene, public safety, and who belongs in public safety. And the way your practice is, we feed on each other in public safety. So if you take something from us, it goes to the other, or it goes to the cash balance that's generally required. From my point of it, and it's going to make the world a lot harder, is that that's not the way life is. Life doesn't live in stovepipes with the public safety that just happens to have in some group, and then some other group over here. If it were competing with public safety, you might get a different outcome. And then I would add your revenue to it. It's one of the consequences. One of the transfers, if you transfer a particular, I think it's, I'm not sure what it is, transfer one of the things we do to some other court, you'll lose more in state revenue than you gain in not funding us to do the job. So you're absolutely right that that's just something you have to keep an eye on. And those are really tough decisions, but I'm confident you're up to making those decisions. You're right.
I also want to remind the committee, too, that, and I think the committee's well aware, but, while we're the public safety subcommittee, the courts stretch far beyond the public safety needs of our populace. They stretch in addition to redressing civil rights and civil grievances amongst and among each other. And so I think that that's an anomaly that we don't see really in the other budgets that we view in terms of what is the core function, what are the basic and core functions of government and the expectations of the public. So, further questions for the chief? Thank you, Chief. Kingsley, are you ready?
Yes.
She's shuffling papers.
I was thinking we could talk a little bit more about the how we got to the budget reduction plan and scenario that we're in now, but I think what I'll do is when we go through our overview and we talk about how it changes for 03-05, I can bring in some additional facts. I did want to just mention before we left that topic, before we got to this plan, we had already been through three special sessions, so we had already gone through cuts, one-time cuts, as Chief mentioned, layoffs, just general what I'd call thin the soup and reductions. And this is kind of what we call the 5100 plan. We were at that point where there really was nowhere else to go but further into staff and into services. But there was a long list of cuts we had made leading up to this point. And as the Chief mentioned, the emphasis on the staff reductions was a hope to save another 100 staff that we might not have to lay off, which, barring an 0305 number that lets us over the biennium keep those on, then the equivalent of the deferral will end up being in layoffs by June 30th. But we were hoping not to have to lose people, more people, let's put it that way, since the combination of the 275, which were vacancies, layoffs, and the reductions so far, the equivalent of the furlough was about another 113 people worth, and so we came up about 26%, 27% of our workforce statewide workforce not being around. What we were going to try and do today was today just to, at a high level, walk an overview kind of structure for the department and your budget discussions, and I'll try to keep it at that level, but let you ask questions if I'm going too fast or you want more information. I did break it out so you wouldn't just have my talking voice when we get to revenue. After, I'll go over kind of the overview, but Susan Klosterman and Doug Bray will talk about the revenue and collections part, and then Carl Ward and I believe Jim Adams will be talking about the technology plan, and Doug Bray also. And that way, I think you'll have the whole piece. And then tomorrow, there was some interest in having invited testimony, people coming in to talk about what has been the impact on various users of the court and the public by the cut so far, and after they kind of hear what 0305 looks like, what they see, and also then talk about some of the local court checks. And then Wednesday, hoping to get back into the critical workload that how do you know if you have enough judges or don't? How do you know if you have enough staff or don't? What are the efficiencies? What are the models? I can tell you I have looked at some of the other state court systems, and I can give you more information on that. I've always thought we were pretty good, but it seems to bear that out. But that's because we're working, right? She said danger and opportunity. And it is ironic that we're starting off on the 20th year anniversary of becoming a state-funded system. So January of 83, first of 83. And now we're talking, as you'll see, about maybe breaking it back up again, and maybe just everything's a 20-year cycle. I don't know. We'll find out.
May I? Yes. Mr. Chair, may I interrupt? Gary Alexander is the Chief Justice of the State of Washington, and he called off his sympathy last week, and they are embarking upon a consolidation. Because right now, most of their trial courts are paid for by the counties, as we were until 83, and as California was until about a year ago, but we consolidated. I merely cautioned him that if you do that, you become subject to whatever the state revenues are, and so you put all your eggs in one revenue basket as a downside. I'm confident they'll go ahead and go for consolidation, because it's worked generally well for us. Excuse the interruption.
Just so the committee knows, I talked to the National Center for State Courts this morning on the phone, and was talking to them about consolidation, what other states have done. They're looking at some national numbers, too, for me. So.
Actually, they were looking at us for what we did 20 years ago, as a matter of fact.
Oh, I know. Several people are looking at what we did.
Okay. We've gone and testified on consolidation. How wonderful is how much more efficient you are as a state-funded system. Of course, it gives you one... I guess one target, too, is the opposite.
Gives you one pot of money.
Yeah. And I would mention that the Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals is here. Because we gave the overview on what courts do to the combined group, we weren't doing an overview on individual courts again, but she's here for specific questions having to do with the Court of Appeals or overall the budget cuts, because they've been one of the heavily hit in their support staff services in this biennium. And I would mention in the national study, I did confirm that as of year 2000, they're still the third highest caseload per capita in the nation still in the Court of Appeals.
Is it part of your plan to be
Judge Deeds?
Your Honor, is it part of your plan to be, you're not going to be part of the presentation? I just don't want to.
She's going to take
an interlocutory
appeal.
Everyone's time is valuable right now, so I just want to make sure that we can save questions for Court of Appeals to the end, if that's easier. we can save questions if you want, and we can bring you back on Thursday if you want to do that, Your Honor. since I know we have one of the busiest appellate cases in the country.
Well, this is one of those parties where you don't know you want to be president or be afraid not to be president because of new assignments that will be given. And I did, just to set the stage, want to put in context when we go into our budget discussions that we are, you know, just 2%, the whole branch is just 2% of the general fund, at least the court system is. And in further context of saying that if you take every man, woman, and child, the population of the state of Oregon, this is what it costs you a day, a dime to run your state court system, your court operations.
I
know. Well, after I heard you talk, I thought I should have brought two nickels and say we still have two nickels to rub together, but that's only if you fund the Chief Justice's operating level. So, and this is the Chief Justice's operating level, so it's 10 cents a day for court operations, and that's appellate, admin, and trial courts. It does not include mandated payments, which is your jury and interpreters, and that will cost you another half cent if you include that in your, so have that 10 and a half cents a day. And tomorrow I'll bring the jar and we can add for every day we're here. By the end of the week, well, we only have 4 days, so we won't make it quite up to $3 or a latte.
I asked the Center for State Courts this morning if there was a comparison, and I know states use different models. Obviously, a lot of states use county money or state money. Is there a model that's out? Not that it's going to be fully indicative of where we're at, but they weren't aware of a model as to, you know, by population. You just gave us a population example. Is that a population example or revenue example?
It's a population example, Oregon's population. And
I'd asked this morning about what other states compare, what other states in the West at least compare, and I don't know if you've seen anything like that, but it, the chair would be interested, and I think the committee would be interested. It would be instructive to know what other states spend.
Mr. Chair, I know they are gathering that information. Was it, they're about state 10, what I would call unified state court systems, where they're more state-funded than anything else, and then there's some that are in the middle that are partials, and then the others, and so that is sometimes a problem with the comparisons, and then also their jurisdictional setups make a difference. What their lower courts are, if they have district circuit, JPs, some have probate courts, you know, ancillary courts that handle some caseload and are funded through a different mechanism. So there are some broader base comparisons, and we were trying to look at that too, but it is more difficult now that many of the court systems are in the states are facing the same budget crisis. Everybody's trying to compare, and there are a number of primers, if you would call them, on funding court systems, and a lot of them rely on the same sort of mechanisms that we do. They're usually heavily based on general fund, but some do have fees that are dedicated to the courts, and they charge user fees for different things than we charge, and you know, but basically the concept of your court system not being beholden to certain players make them primarily a general funded type of funding source. We do in our budget, as of last biennium, the collections, the people who do collections and accounting are funded from revenues coming in. And back then we thought we were smart. We were like paring down the core court just so you just funded the general fund for the really important stuff and you didn't have to all the other things that mattered but weren't part of our core. Our core statutory and constitutional duties would be just general funded, and now those are the ones that are doing okay. You know, through the layoffs, we didn't have to lay off any collections people. We didn't have to lay off, you know, people that are funded through other sources. So, ironically, it was people who staffed the courtroom and got the cases through, and those that were heavily hit. So, it will be interesting to see if we. We have not found the model that you're looking for, but we were trying to do some comparisons. I did do population comparisons. The two states that were most like Oregon, just population-wise, you know, 3.4 to 3.5 million people, were Connecticut and Oklahoma. Connecticut is a unified court system. Oklahoma was not. judge-wise, they had more judges than we did per 100,000 people, and our pending caseloads were higher. So I do have some of those numbers. I mean, I always thought we were, for unified court systems, National Center says that there is about from 2 to 6 judges per 100,000, and we're almost at, we're about 4.5 judges. I have to do the ones that come online at the end, but I didn't have our projected population judges per 100,000. So means for every like 21,000 people, we have a judge. And we do have some of those comparisons that we could provide for. I don't know if that helps find more money. Maybe it does go to, are we being efficient where we can? Justice is not necessarily an efficient thing. If you, as a chief, has a, there's a great case that the victim was between being expedient and expeditious. And which did you want with justice? So,
if I may, Mr. Chairman, that was a bill that passed out of here in years past asking us to be expedient. And Justice Graber wrote a footnote in the opinion and said, I'm assuming that the legislature meant expeditious. It's a whole different mindset on how you proceed. And so we try to be expeditious and not expedient.
Representative Butler.
Kingsley, you've mentioned issues of collections, and last session Senator Carnell and I tried to figure out a way that we could accelerate and assist with accelerating the collections by offering local staff, not paid for by the state, but by bringing some of those local staff, and we were summarily turned down. I'm wondering how you're coming with your overall collections. Is that something that's significantly improved as a result of additional personnel that you get working on that, or the additional computer systems? What's happened there?
Chair Patridge, Representative Butler. Yes, Susan will give you, it's in the handout, but she'll give you a much more detailed overview of it. But the collections people are paid for from as part of the revenue at a less cost than it does in other collection scenarios like Department of Revenue and those. It has increased quite a bit. And it's been what I would say a 6-8 year thing, because we had to get legislation changed and then get staffing and get staff hired. But it has made a difference. And if I can let her go into more of the facts
That's
and
fine.
Figures, we'll do that. And I, it's probably never enough, but I hope you'll be pleased.
Hope so.
In our overview presentation materials, what I call the agency format that we're asked to present in, ask you to provide information on your mission and goals. And ironically, the judicial branch of government actually has had them, starting with the Futures Committee in 1992. The Chief Justice will talk more on another day about some of the things that have come out of that. But it did seek to look towards the future and more define what it is that the branch of government does and how it wants to prioritize what it does, which emphasizes fair, accessible, and timely justice and values and goals that are consistent with that. On page three, without going into all the chapters and verse, just wanting to set the context that whatever we do is really prescribed by the Constitution and statute, and to the extent that you want us to perform less of those functions, then we'll have can do legislative vehicles for that. But we really, everything we do is, the genesis is usually in the statute or the Constitution. And I know people have done searches and court shell appears 3,000 times in the ORS, and you could change all those to may and if you have enough money and those sorts of things. But really what we do is defined by you to a large degree. Our court jurisdictional structure, I'm not going to spend a lot of time except to the extent of questions. You've had this in kind of many overviews before. For the state-funded system, it's the Supreme Court with the 7 judges. and the Court of Appeals with the 10 judges. We have the tax court with one judge and six magistrates. The circuit courts at the beginning of the biennium had 163 judges. As of January 1st, had 166 judges. And then June 30th, and this is why it shows this for July 1st, our new biennium would have 169 judges. And they are in the 27 judicial districts. I would, on the next page, on page 6, you can see the judicial district map. Ironically, a lot of the Midwestern states, every county is a judicial district, so they have 103 judicial districts. And so, actually, Oregon's on a fairly manageable scale. Most of the times where we have multiple counties in a district, there are smaller courts, or the distance makes it conducive. And when you were talking about efficiencies, one of the things, or consolidating judicial districts, one of the questions would be, what is it you were seeking to do? Because right now the judges that we do have in the state are all by Chief Justice order pro tem to sit in all the districts of the state and in the Court of Appeals, and vice versa. The Court of Appeals judges are also have pro tem order to be able to sit in the courts. And we do quite we have a person in our office who spends quite a lot of time helping with the trades of judges who need to be in other jurisdictions around our state. So we do a lot of that already. The Chief Justice also by statute has authority to summarily, though he doesn't usually exercise it, to move someone for 2 weeks, you know, whether they wanted to or not, to another district to help out. But because we're a state-funded system and we're a state system, and you know, everybody looks at themselves as part of a bigger whole that they need to help out with, and we have quite a bit of coordination. Now, what we might need is a little, you know, van with some staff that goes from place to place. But you can also do that by putting temporary funds in our budget, so you can hire temporaries. But that's not done as a state budgeting tool. You can only hire temps if you hold vacancies open or defer some other costs. So I just mentioned that. If depending on what the problem is or the issue that we want to fix, there are probably a number of ways we could look at it.
Sure.
Representative Butler.
When was the last time the judicial district's map was looked at? It seems unusual that Lake County stands out there as the 26th district, all by its lonesome with about 7,000 people.
It's been in and out. Chief Justice,
Chair, may I certainly welcome discussion with Representative Butler on this matter. When I was here, I was not in Ways and Means. I worked a good part of my time to get rid of the sitting, not the person, but the position in Lake County. I had a circuit judge at the time. And we did. When that circuit judge retired, Lake joined Klamath County. And it served that until your predecessor, I think it was your predecessor, decided that, whose district included Lake County, that they needed at least a district court judge. And so, not during my watch, the legislature added a district court judge to sit in Lakeview. Then, as a result of a consolidation of the courts, which I didn't support, again, and that was championed by a Klamath County representative, all the district courts became circuit courts. So you have a circuit court in Lake County with a very good judge with a very small population. 30 years ago, the effort was to get away with it and add it to do away with it and add it to Klamath. That lasted 15, 20 years and went back to a separate district. And I think I could probably go through most of the we're going the other direction, by the way. We're adding districts. You may be familiar when Mal Heuer and Harney were together, and Grant and Baker were together, and then the workload shifted substantially, and Mal Heuer became almost a valley county in terms of workload. Then it was split, and Baker went by itself, and Grant joined Harney, and Mal Heuer went by itself. So there are a lot of things to consider, but I would say that's always a legislative prerogative, because the question is how long ago. I think it was last year or last session is the last time a change was made. So
I would add that the trial court administrator, who's located in Klamath Falls, is a trial court administrator for both judicial districts. They do not have two trial court administrators. And the judge, Judge Simpson, does go over and help with Klamath County cases. So there is at least that, whether the name of being a separate judicial district has a cachet to it or not. Just right above that, just the page 5 is, I think you're aware of this from our overviews in the past too, but the Chief Justice not only is the presiding judge for the Supreme Court, but also is head of the over administrative structure of the judiciary, of the state-funded judiciary, and he appoints on a 2-year basis and every odd years in the statute presiding judge for each of the judicial districts. They in turn have a trial court administrator who it runs the day-to-day operations and works with them in close harmony to work with the community on overall issues. And then I don't know if we call ourselves headquarters, but our office is the centralized infrastructure for both the appellate courts and the trial courts, provide the human resources. So instead of having in the 36 counties or 27 judicial districts, 27 personnel officers, we have 4 human service officers that serve our entire workforce and the judges. Same with budget and finance, IT, legal, provide all those. We also are the appellate records office for the Supreme Court Court of Appeals and provide those services in our budget, as well as there are some by statute separate programs that are ascribed to the Chief Justice to administer, which in indigent defense until the transfer occurs, but also the Citizen Review Board and the State Law Library and the Interpreters Program and a Shorthand Reporters Program. So all those things we have two, and the Chief gets to see over them, and I'm his sidekick, so we try to split it. You're supposed to give the good news of that, and I'm supposed to give the bad news in the presentation or something. So the state court administrator is a statutory position, and there are things that you can increase or decrease in that, and I can give you a list of if our office is staffed to do those types of functions. Major organizational changes, page 7. The only one that's happening in the immediate time frame will be the indigent defense transfer based on legislation from last time. That's on page 7. As we mentioned in the past, we became a state-funded system in 83, and the only two major structural changes other than Lake County being a separate judicial district or not, and a couple others, has been the creation of the Tax Magistrates Division in 97, which came over from the Department of Revenue and kind of became a judicial proceeding. And then, of course, a very large structural change was the merger of the district courts into the circuit courts, and we now have a unified, you know, trial court. It handles everything. There are JP, Justice of the Peace Courts, usually in the more rural areas with large geographic distances. They are county funded. I don't know what the latest count. It's usually 27 to 30 of those around the state. And they're municipal courts that usually handle municipal ordinances and things like that. And they're about, last count, I think it was about 150 of those around the state. But the trial court, which handles everything, is by statute in each of the centers of each of the counties. And in some of the counties, their statutory designation to hold court in other parks and in other cities within that county. So there is an inherent inefficiency in the sense of we don't have field offices to close. As long as you want a circuit court, state court presence in every county, if that's an important part of offering justice and access to the people, I think it is. But that, I mean, that's an inherent inefficiency. We have joked with our budget cuts of rolling up from the state, you know, like, well, these months we'll quit serving Klamath and Lake, and, you know, pretty soon we'll just move the judges and the staff all up to the valley. The other thing that we've discussed, well, we would have, just like the old circuit rider days, here would be your 3 months you get to be open, here are your 3 months you get to be open. And but those are all, I hope, tongue-in-cheek, and we're not there. I know with the 0305, depending on funding levels, we may need to look at courts with smaller amounts of filings and staffing and say maybe they can't be 5 days a week. But ones that are Multnomah or Washington, where they have huge numbers of cases and jails and stuff, maybe, you know, that's where you have to do 5 days a week.
Kingsley, how many of the courts at this time are 5 day or 4 day versus 5 day of the circuit courts?
Right now, all the courts are 4 days.
All of
between
them.
March and June 30th. Prior to that, and that's by Chief Justice order. Prior to that, Umatilla was Morrow was the only one that was a 4 day court. All the courts from the last session had reduced what we call restricted public access hours. Some would close during lunch or half days on certain days in order to let the staff go and get entries of judgment done and receding. They would close the public counters, but they didn't close off trials and things like that. Now we're in 4 days is the operational days.
I thought I saw at some point the list of cases that were backlogging. Do we have that information that we'll go through?
Yes, Representative Butler, I believe that you may have seen, I don't know if it was with the revenue discussion we talked about what percent of them might be done in the 0305, because it would be a truncated priority. If you didn't take any off the plate, then you might try and do 90 to 100% of the first four priorities and 80%, just as far as the timelines went. You still would be putting your emphasis on the high public safety, and that may have been what you saw.
I think Representative Patridge has a list of cases that backlog and begin to build up by the end of just a few months.
Right. And the non-person and small claims are the ones that are the two that are deferred during this March through June period. So those are backing up the other ones, since the budget cuts have been backing up as well, just at a different pace. Page 10 is probably the most macro view of the budget numbers. As we get into the books and the others, we'll have the breakouts with mandated and administration and trial courts, but at the total level for the chief's operating budget for the general fund, and that's when you see the comparisons, this is $268.4 million. Now, he has a recommended budget that's higher than $298 million. That includes $31 million in packages that we'll talk about. Some were legislative placeholder funding, some will go to critical staffing and other things, you know, and we will have some interest in letting you know about a few of them so you can make some concrete decisions about what the court's going to look like. But this $268.4 million is certainly our one primary budget goal if we have one out of that whole number. Other funds and federal funds, will go through a lot of the changes, and those have to do with some of the federal funding sources for children, review of children and out-of-home care, some drug court grants, some of the revenue collections issues, and we'll go through those when we get to those numbers. I know that there's I think we'll do that. I guess we'll go through that later. What are the changes from the beginning of 99 and then the beginning of 01 and the beginning of this biennium? Because I'm supposed to stay at the high level right now, right? Okay, moving on. 11 and 12 are just different pie looks at how the Chief Justice's operating number, that $268.4 million plus the federal fund and other funds, look, trial courts are 68% of the department budget mandated payments, which are jury and interpreter primarily, and have other expenses in there. The ancillary cost of holding a proceeding is what we call them. There's 5%, and then appellate administration is about 27%. As Robin mentioned, all the state assessments are in administration for the for all the courts, and as well as the cost of the programs that I mentioned, the infrastructure for the courts, and then the support of the appellate courts. 12 just gives you a breakdown of the general fund versus federal and other funds, and as you can see, we're over 90% general funded. When Susan goes through some of the revenue and collections to talk a little bit about where some of the other monies come from, the bullets explain that some are directly for the collections, others are OGIN online. We have over 2,000 non-OJD users who access our court databases and provide some funds that way to support it.
So there are charges to use access the OJD?
Not for what I would call the general information, but for certain dial-up right now there are, until we have a, and then for special reports that are run. Often title companies and certain businesses want special data reports run, and so there are charges for that. And Carl, when he gets to technology, can explain a little bit more. It's something that the legislature provided for, I think it's been about 12 years. It was in the... Hold on, biennials just fly. No, it was in the early mid-90s. I'm not going to go through Section 7, the revenue part, because Susan will. I'm going to bump ahead to, though we covered a lot of it, page 16, major budget issues. It's really, once again, that page in 17 and 18 are the gist of what we're facing for 03-05, the difference between... We call the Chief Justice's maintenance level, which is basically funding what you have had at the beginning of last biennium with any changes, and keeping the courts open, keeping all the case types, and keeping relatively timely. It's not the Chief's, what I call, ideal budget, which was fully staffed, fully judged, and a number of programs that we think would be important to the citizens. This is just taking us where we were a few special sessions ago and hoping to make up for lost ground before we're totally dismantled.
And that maintenance budget is $20.1 million different than the governor's printed budget?
It's actually 30, but if you take out because we're talking about just the general funded part, if you take out the inflation factor and the second merit, then it's about $26 million difference. There's an additional inflation factor that's part of the indigent defense contract inflation stuff that would be in the transfer. So when we're talking just operational and mandated compared to the governor's minus inflation and second merit, then we're talking about a $26 million difference. On page 17, as the Chief mentioned, and we'll talk about it more when we get into our dollar numbers, the budget reduction, do I have to give you my 10 cents? The Budget Reduction Advisory Committee, so the acronym.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you. Kingsley, quick. Okay. So it'd be 268 mm-hmm. for maintaining kind of the basic operating level. The governor's printed budget is $26 million less than that. And then we're not figuring in the adjustments that Ways and Means have been talking about in terms of directions based on lesser revenue projections.
Right.
So that could be another 8% below the 238.
You're talking about another 10% cut or 8% or not, right?
The governor's budget, printed budget, is really about $30 million different,
right.
But your basic maintenance was 26 and change.
Right, with the inflation and the second merit. And then if you adjusted the chief's, if you took that as a gap. And of that, I mean, the governor and his number did not break out between operations and mandated. What we've done for most of our budget purposes is right now just look at it as if it were a straight across adjustment. What would operations look like and what would mandated look like? Because our mandated payments, our jury and interpreters are in the chief's budget are roughly $14.4 million. And so our what I call our base operational general fund number is around $254 million. So.
And when we go through the budget, we'll see each of the costs of those various items, including cost of interpreters and
yes.
All those kinds
yes,
of
and we've updated the numbers on that. On page 17, and we'll come back to this when we look at what we want to do for the long term. The Chief Justice's Budget Reduction Advisory Committee looked at what had been the priorities that we had been using pretty much for the last 9 years and said, going for the long term now, we're going to probably have to make long-term reductions and how do you feel about the priorities? So there were some changes, things that have been what I call case types that are case processing things were taken off that list, like alternative dispute resolution, family and drug courts. It doesn't mean we didn't think they were important, but they were part of if you kept a certain case type, then the ADR that went with that would probably still be worked in. It's just not just cleaned them out and left it just cases. Then there were some adjustments. The top part stayed the same as far as the priorities. There were some adjustments in the latter six items. And post-conviction relief went to the bottom, though that may be a false saving in the long run because cases would then probably get filed as habeas corpus cases, which are way up at the top because they're constitutionally protected writs. So you may clean out some cases, but as far as prioritizing what we had, they are on the bottom. And small claims, property only, probate, and civil. And as Chief mentioned, this isn't an economic model. It went with the courts and the mission, and that would be timely completion of the most important public safety and child safety, vulnerable citizen cases first. It is in no way mean that we don't think they're important, and in no way means that we don't want to do them. We really do, and we think we're the most efficient forum in many respects to do them, though those are there are alternatives you can do with certain case types with either county or justice courts or other sorts of forums if that's a policy decision, and we will help very, very much with that. 18 is page 18 is what you've seen, the priorities for 0305 displayed starting with the chief's budget and the governor's budget, and just saying using the numbers of case costs. And you might ask, where do those case costs come from? And we will be getting into that more on Wednesday, but we had workload studies done for the staff and the judges in the 2009-01 biennium, and those are the weights of how much time it takes for staff versus judges to do particular kind of cases, and those weights and those amount of minutes and workload minutes translate into how many dollars of personnel time and judge time, which translate into how much does a case cost in a certain category or that group of cases. So there is a methodology behind, and when you take like $30 million and say, okay, we're locking out $30 million, you can go up and say, well, how much staff and judge resources go to that particular case type. Now, there's some false economy when you get to a certain point because really, since you're not doing all cases in and out in the same year, I mean, and you, if you only have five people, those people are one-tenth of them are doing small claims, and the other tenth of their body's doing criminal, and the other tenth of their body's doing civil. And so, but statewide, we can, you can quantify that into people and dollars of our budget and make some judgments on that. And then you add in, we talked about the minimum of, if you are going to be in every county, every judicial district, you know, there's a minimum cost opening your doors and providing equal justice opportunities for the citizens, even if you are in a sparsely populated jurisdiction. So, and page 19 is one that's another one of those context things, which it just shows once again that the chief's budget is 2%, the general funded part is about 2% of your total general funds for 2003-05. And at one time, in the good days, we were clear up to 2.87% just for operations, and that would be about $73 million more than the governor's budget has. Notice, now Puerto Rico is not a state, but it is a commonwealth that has a system that's based on the same as many. They're part of our, what I call our Conference of State Courts work group, and they just pass a constitutional measure that mandated a certain percentage of the general fund be dedicated to the court system for the judicial branch. And so it's a percent of whatever funds are available. So I thought that was an interesting way to ensure Puerto Rico, huh? Puerto Rico, so I don't know. there are some other states that do have a constitutional provision that says whatever number that the Chief Justice provides for maintenance is the number that they have to balance to. Our state's a little different. It kind of dances around that. It doesn't really say, though, there is a respect for what the governor, you know, the inner branch. The governor has to do a balanced budget, but he... Or she usually gives some respect to the legislative branch and judicial branch as far as their current, what I call old current service level concept, Chief Justice is operating.
Especially the judges passing out an initiative for signature in the various courts and seeing if we can get a 2% set aside. The 2% looks like it would handle it according to the 10 cents a day.
And then with CPI tied to that, and we'd be done, right?
Well, if it's a percentage of the
that's true,
percentage
it would
of the
be.
General yeah. fund, as soon as the general fund goes up, you get more money.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator?
Just
please.
Make sure it's a single subject. If
you
yeah.
Sorry. But that's why I ask. If maybe we had the circuit judges circulating that, then, I mean, which one of them is going to give you the bad opinion?
Policy packages, I'm looking at the table of contents, can I tell you the things that are next kind of in page order here. The policy packages, which are, these are just the legislative related ones, there are other ones. I said we're not, probably have reasons that those aren't going forward at this time. But the strategic planning, performance measures, partnerships with state government, those are all items that we were asked to have a separate presentation on, so the performance measures in the futures we'll talk about that I think a little bit tomorrow and more on Wednesday. We do have in the caseload and workload statistics, which are also in our budget document, but will be referred to during the discussion of workload of staff and judge workload issues, so they're just in there for our later use. The budget notes start on page 58, and we had 9 budget notes from 3 different bills, and we have complied with all of them. Most of them usually ended up with a report to a specific legislative committee or an e-board appearance. We've documented what we did with each of those. I'm just thinking in the interest of your time, I won't belabor them. Collections we'll be talking about in just a minute with Susan, and the same with IT. The other ones had to do with actually judge and staff workload issues. And
let me just ask this.
Sure.
You're going through this pretty good clip, which is fine. But in my And one of the comments here, you reviewed the historic changes within the court system. And let's see, the most recent of those was which one?
Public defense transfer.
Yeah, the public defense. What year was that?
That was last session, and you transferred it in different time stages, and you.
What's the difference between the 1999 right. budget and the current 03-05
budget? No, the
difference?
Last biennium's budget and ours, because the 169, roughly 169 million that had been our indigent defense account will be in the Public Defense Commission Services
okay.
budget. And then the administration, which was roughly 900,000 that was in my office, is also transferred to the Public Defense Commission, the staffing, the staffing
okay.
services. And we, in our numbers here and in the handouts, we've treated it as a July 1st transfer. There is a bill for you to do that. Otherwise, in our budget, there's about a three-month pocket of funds that are for July 1st through October 1st when the statute now provides for the transfer
okay.
to occur. But for our discussion purposes, we've treated it as a July 1 transfer, and all our numbers have those already taken out.
And Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the purposes of making comparisons, the LFO analysis of the agency budget shows it both ways.
Mm-hmm.
It
true.
Shows historical with
indigent, okay.
both with and without. That's why there are two tables for each of the sections, so that each of the sections where there was indigent defense included, so that you can, if you're trying to track expenditures over time, you don't have the problem of trying to figure out what was indigent defense and what wasn't.
And then you've used the last 0305, one is the governor's recommended, and the other is the Chief Justice's recommended.
That's correct. So you have a picture of both of those also.
And let's see, that Kingsley, that I think you used the figure of 2%. Was that what that figure was that you used previously?
Right. That did not include indigent defense and just general funds, not other federal.
Okay. What would that percentage be if you walk back through that without the indigent defense? Would it be a steady 2%?
Oh, that is just operations through the last
the
10 years, right, or
that's
20
okay.
years. Right. With indigent defense, it's like 2.89%, I believe, was
and
our last biennium number.
A steady 2%?
No. With indigent defense, but just for operations, it's, I think it was like 1.79 at one point. We have it, I know I have the last three biennium, we might have that further. What percent of the general fund,
mm-hmm.
just operations, which would be operations and mandated, were of the general fund? So why not? And that's what that chart, I should ask Gail, that's what that chart does. Page 19. But that is the historical with that indigent defense
that
out
has
from
indigent
91
defense, doesn't it?
Out.
It's out. So it's with indigent defense subtracted out, back in 1991 it was nearing 3% and it's now at 2%.
Right.
What's the
constitutional one would be better to put it at 3%, right?
What's the phenomenon that's happened to us there? Going from 3% of the general fund to 2% with the general fund decreasing, it looks like it has a compounding effect on us.
Well, actually, during the 90s, I was going to say there was more general fund. And
yeah, Mr. Chair, members
five.
Of the committee, during this period of time, that up until 2001-03, the general fund was increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So you won't see that their budget, Mr. Chair, is taking that kind of a reduction. It's just that because the general fund was increasing significantly,
mm-hmm.
their share of it
was decreasing.
And it's more to illustrate that as a percent of the overall general fund, our needs have been met with less overtime than more, though there's a point. So, and then when you're looking at balancing out all those priorities you have to make, 2% for your judicial branch, same as for your legislative branch, to operate at a level that is at least, you can still call it a branch.
Are there any states that do, in fact, set aside a constitutionally protected percentage for the operation of the state courts?
I mentioned the one. I'll look and see if there are others. I do know that others have a different sort of language in the sense that they just print what the Chief Justice provides as a number for them, and they balance to that. But I'll bring forth some other other states.
I would appreciate that. Thank you. I guess where I'm going, committee, is that I'm not a lawyer, but this is a whole separate branch of government, and if they could be assured of a steady funding stream, that would certainly be one way to provide it. That's why I'm wondering. Most other constitutions, state constitutions, would provide that as a separate branch of government, that it would have some kind of a steady funding stream, I would think, and hope to be able to find that there's some method of doing that.
I think there's going to be some that will find equivalent, just because not less than a third of them are state funded, they may not have provisions for that. Two-thirds of states may, since it's county funds or other ways of funding, they may not have that specific. What I'd like to do with your remaining time is give you a chance to hear a little bit about the revenue and collections part, and I see if we have time. Otherwise, we'll go over till tomorrow. But if
you want to hit the tops off the revenue piece, Susan, maybe.
Yes.
And then I think we'll defer IT until tomorrow. Your IT people can leave if you want, but you're more than welcome to stay.
Thinking if we as the legislature choose not to fund the judiciary branch, maybe they could just shift some of the duties back to legislatures or to us, and we could be assigned small claims court or something for our district. Or
pro tem, it could be
do divorces and things like that.
We might be more
over as a legislative function.
We might be more effective here, sitting listening to small claims court statewide every 6 months, every other year. For
I thought there was small claims court.
In our spare time, when you're not in hearing, you have to be down there on the small claims court panel.
I want to look at that half a penny that she's got there.
I don't think she's defaced U.S. Treasury property, though, Mr. Chair.
Half a penny here in my wallet.
You got a half a penny? Susan, why don't you just give us kind of a real brief highlight on this, and then why don't we hold for a few minutes and see if there's questions so we know the general direction we'll start off with tomorrow. And then I have a couple things just for housekeeping business for the committee. So why don't you do that? Can we do that?
Certainly.
Does that make some sense?
Yes.
I know it's put you on a tight timeline, but
that's fine, Mr. Chair. I was here a few weeks ago talking about revenue, so some of this may be redundant anyway. For the record, my name is Susan Klosterman, and I'm the Deputy State Court Administrator for Business Operations. And here also is Doug Bray. He's the Multnomah Circuit Court Trial Court Administrator. And if we could take just a minute to answer Representative Butler's question about the new positions that were funded last session for collections as part of Senate Bill 70, there was also a fund shift which just moved a number of collections and revenue administration staff from the general funding source to be funded from the revenue stream of monies collected. But in addition to that, there were 10 limited duration positions that were funded to take care of a $92 million backlog of cases in Multnomah County that had not yet been reported into our accounts receivable management system. And once placed in that system, those accounts then are pretty much managed by the system, and it becomes much less labor-intensive process. We did report on the status of the collections in Multnomah to the June and also just recently the January Emergency Board. And at that time, and Doug could probably say this better than I can, but I don't know that he has the report with him. He can certainly tell you where he is today. But at that time in January when we reported to the Emergency Board, the $92 million backlog had been decreased to $30 million. So $60 million had been entered into the active collections process, and most of that turned over to the Department of Revenue for collections. And the revenues in Multnomah, when we reported in January, were up 13.5% from the prior period in the last biennium, and that is a bit related to new fees added as a result of Senate Bill 70, but to a large extent is certainly related to the collections of the backlog. And I didn't mean to put words in your mouth, Doug, but you probably have something to add.
Representative Patridge, this is Doug Bray, I'm trial court administrator in the Circuit Court for Multnomah County. With the 10 positions that were added with the Senate Bill 70 approval of the other fund positions, I mean, we have been able to set up a collections department within the Circuit Court. And with the collections department, we have emphasized two things. First of all, on current accounts receivable, we make sure every account receivable has a notice sent immediately and that the information is provided to the debtor of the amount of fees they amount that they owe and what the collection costs will be if they don't pay within 30 days. Those cases are automatically then entered into the collection system if there's no payment within 30 days, and it proceeds on to referral to Department of Revenue or to an outside collections agency. For the backlog, we began adding the backlog cases back into the system starting in January or working towards January 2002. And actually, as of the 1st of March, of the $92 million that was outstanding, there is currently a balance of $7.5 million that's not in the collection system. We are working and working those cases that are in and working towards having the rest of the cases added in. There will always be a certain percentage of cases that are still outside of the collection system simply because it does take a little time from the creation of the debt to get it into the system. We've increased revenue over the 20 months up to the 1st of March by $5.9 million. And that's, as Susan said, that's a 13.5% increase in revenue collected in Multnomah County. The Chief Justice alluded to the fact that Multnomah County is a revenue center for the state court system. Because we are the municipal court for the city of Portland, we have collection responsibility for all municipal court matters as well as the traditional circuit court matters. And that includes about 350,000 parking citations per year. So on a monthly basis, it costs about $1.7 million to run the circuit court, and we collect about $2.5 million in total revenue each month. All of that money, of course, none of it stays with us except for the collection percentage fees that funds the other funded positions, and the rest goes into the general fund or to the CFAA. Any questions?
Representative Hanson. You okay? We got those AEDs somewhere close?
There's something in here.
All right.
So if I'm, would I be right in characterizing the difference between the $84 million projected in income and the governor's budget based at $156 million as being more than the difference between the governor's budget and the Chief Justice's budget? The differences that or that if we cut $26 million from the Chief Justice's budget, we'll have a revenue loss that will be roughly $28 million.
Mr. Chair and Representative Hanson, you're correct. A few weeks ago, in the context of the criminal fines and assessment account, we discussed the impact of the governor's balanced budget level of funding on processing cases through the courts. And at that time, it was time for us to submit a revenue forecast to the Office of Economic Analysis for the March revenue forecast. So we had talked with Legislative Fiscal and with the Office of Economic Analysis about what level of funding we should assume for the 03-05 biennium budget, because at that time we had gotten information about the governor's balanced budget. So what we did was assume the impact of the governor's balanced budget, which takes us through the civil processing of cases on the next biennial budget. But since there has been no change in the statutory requirements on the judicial department or the courts for processing cases, what we did at that time was what we call the thinning of the soup revenue forecast. We just assumed what would happen to all the different case types if they basically slowed down based on a reduced level of staff and funding. And that is the difference between the $184.9 million and the $156.8 million. So we're saying that with Chief Justice's operating level budget, we would be able to continue processing all cases as we had earlier, the very beginning of this biennium, and would realize the revenues at that level.
Members of the committee, there are components of the Chief Justice's operating level that are not directly staffing related. The inflation adjustment, the second merit, there are reductions that will be made to this budget that ought not to have that same direct correlation to the revenue, but it's something we're going to have to look into. So I wouldn't take that one-to-one or that ratio right now as being the absolute point at which the revenue drops off. We're going to have to take a look at, you know, what the roll-up costs are that are being that would be backed out, and then what the staffing impact is going to be.
Okay. So that, Mr. Chair, is one of the highlights of this presentation, I guess, is the impact on processing cases to the revenue forecast. And there is, as Robin said, it isn't an all or nothing thing. If there are reductions that have corresponding revenue or cost reductions, okay, then there would not be.
Why don't I go ahead and stop you there, Susan, and are there specific comments by the committee as to what they'd like to see as part of the revenue piece for tomorrow so that they can have those in the forefront of their mind? Or are you just waiting to spring the questions? All right. Senator Devlin.
I've been trying to be careful asking this question since I haven't been here for most of this meeting. It may be contained within all the materials here that I've been trying to look through, but in terms of your prioritization list, in terms of if you were no longer performing some services, could we get a fairly clear picture of how much revenue is involved with those services that you would not be performing?
Certainly, Mr. Chair, and I think that was one of the handouts, and we can bring it back tomorrow from the criminal fines and assessment account discussion, was the estimated revenues by the different case categories.
Okay. Thanks. All right. I'm going to do some housekeeping matters then for the committee. We'll continue the hearing over Senate Bill 5523 until tomorrow, and we appreciate you being here. I was just going to pass out to the committee. Everyone knows I've been kind of working on a priority list. I put a disclaimer at the top. The following is a draft working list only to aid in the establishment of public safety priorities in light of our current budget situation. It's only to be used as a tool to help establish priorities. And within each of the broad priority, within each broad priority, the items have not been prioritized and are only listed by department. So if I've so this is listed from 1 to 10. By no means am I wed to this particular, list, nor is this necessarily representative of every single sub-program of a list of every agency. What I've tried to break them down to is logical chunks that are either sub-program or program-level items that to deal with, or the
Kutcher's are going to publish their budget the week, I think, of April 14th. Generally, I'm going to work around with this list. I'd be interested in any input committee members would have. It's not necessarily reflective of what my priorities are in the public safety budget in terms of everything, but if I had to tear apart a public safety system and put it together to some degree, this may be close to what I'd do, but I'm pretty open on things that slide up and slide down, and you know, there's lots of room within the categories to make things happen. They're very scalable. We said it was scalable within the categories. I tried to prioritize those things which were sole source items and constitutionally mandated items at the tops of the list. I've only handed this out to the committee and a few select people around the building. This list now will be a little bit more broadly distributed, but I don't want people to get all upset about it. Just remember,
well, emails are coming.
It's just a tool for us to use. I hope it's helpful. The chair's willing to take the heat, but by the same token, he's not wed to any of his items in particular. So I just wanted to share that. Depends on how small the type is, Senator. All right.
How big his picture is.
And I haven't put all of our ideas and issues. I just tried to put, so if you have some things to fill in, I'm keeping it. And if you have, I'd be interested in any comments from committee members. And as we continue to move forward, I'm going to ask some of the agencies to address some of the issues. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bringing forward the Patridge plan, I think, is a courageous political activity. And you should be complimented.
Standing right behind him.
You'll be watching my back, I'm sure.
From a distance.
Thanks. But, you know, if people have questions about it, please send them to come talk to me or whatever. It's not my intent to get people all hyped up about anything right at this point. And at that point, anything else for the good of the committee? We're adjourned.